Thank you, sir. Appreciate that. Good morning. Happy Father's Day for those of you that are fortunate enough to have children. And my prayers go out to your wives as well. Happy Mother's Day in addition to that. It's always a challenge to have kids and raise them together. The Sunday crowd, I appreciate you guys being here. You guys are like the Sunday savages. You guys have gone through the workout Sunday morning. You're still here, and I appreciate you guys being here, okay? I don't have a slide for this, but I felt the need to throw out a disclaimer. I'm not getting any sponsorship dollars. I'm not getting paid in any amount by any vendor or anything like that. And the $50 that I won yesterday in the name drawing has nothing to do with anything other than me being here, so... All right? But anyway, Javier Manuelos is giving me a hard time about that. Just so I can get started, this is kind of a quick resume, and all it is to represent where I've been at and along the way, the things that I've picked up. Okay, when I was at PSJ North, I was the only athletic trainer there, and I hear there's three there now, so I'm very envious of that situation. Texas A&M, the situation there. We had a chiropractic staff that would volunteer. We had a tremendous sports medicine group, excellent team physician coverage, and that was a great situation. And we also had a rehab specialist, so any of the more in-depth care that was provided by the needed attention post-op was handled by that individual. When I went to Missouri, we didn't have that option. We didn't utilize chiropractic care very, very much. We did have a tremendous sports medicine group, and we handled all of our rehab. So at that point, it became more and more of the individual staff to handle their own rehabilitations, acute or post-op. Okay, at Southeast Missouri State, well, let me go back. At Missouri, I also became acquainted with a gentleman, massage therapist, great individual from San Diego, who helped us with our teams and had a very strong thumb. He swore that he could kill an individual with his thumb. So, and he taught me a lot, so I owe that individual quite a bit. Leaving Missouri to Southeast Missouri State, we were able to, I was in charge of the program. You're going to try and create something in the manner of which you want to operate it as. And tremendous, staff. Our team physician was actually a physiatrist, okay, so that's uncommon to see within our sports medicine realm, and he's still a really good friend of mine, Dr. Jim Bowen. At Southeast Missouri State, we also implemented the FMS system, so I'll talk about that briefly as I get to it, and now at Bowling Green, I'm able to kind of sum up all the experiences that I've seen, the things that I've liked, a lot of the things that I feel could have been tuned up a little bit more, and I'm gonna share that with you as I proceed through this. Background, I've been in sports medicine 20 plus years, a lot of football experience. I do have to backtrack. My whole goal getting out of undergrad was not to be a football guy. I wanted to be a basketball athletic trainer following my time at Pan American, because that's the team that I spent most of the time with. And it turns out I've not seen basketball since I've left Pan Am, so. The 10 years as a lead person for a sports medicine program, 4 years of track and field experience, which may not be a favorite event or sport for most athletic trainers, but that is probably the one assignment that I benefited from the most. All the key injuries, wide variety of specialized events, throwers to distance runners to jumpers, so I tremendously benefited from that. I hit on the FMS work that we did at Southeast Missouri State. And our gentleman, Esteban Rubalcaba, was a dangerous thumb. He spent 2 years with me working with my massage therapy skills. And I've also worked directly with a sports psychologist who also happened to be our head track coach at Mizzou. I'm going to answer some of these. I don't know that I can hear most of your answers, but I'm assuming most of everybody in here is high school-aged kids, right? 15, 14 to 18, maybe 21 years old if the kid's been held back. I don't want to, overstate that, but middle school kids, anybody? Middle? Anybody younger than that? No? Okay. Older than that? Collegiate athletic trainers in here, yes. PTs? I know MDs are going to be scarce at this clinic. MD? PT. All right. Throughout the day, athletic trainers, I think we get to see our kids almost every day, five days a week. If it's more than that, raise your hand. Okay, is it less than 5 days a week? less than 5 days a week. So we have the advantage over any clinician to have more hands-on time with the individual patients. You know, we can see them maybe before classes start, maybe sometime in the middle of the day, maybe after school, before practice, and additionally, you know, if you have help or have hands post-practice as well. As far as the time that these individuals spend training, I'm assuming there's still at least a two-hour limit, correct, per day, per students, right? Unless you're playing football down here, it might go a little bit further than that, including conditioning time, right? Okay. A lot of this, hopefully, is review. These are not necessarily groundbreaking concepts, but they're things that I feel you need to reflect on, okay? There has been, I've probably worked with a dozen strength and conditioning coaches, head strength conditioning coaches, and maybe several dozen assistant strength coaches at every institution that I've been at, beginning at the collegiate setting. And every single one of them agreed that at whatever age a student or a child starts participating in sports, it's okay to expect that individual child, male or female, to have at least a base level of strength, okay? If they start playing soccer, I mean, this is not just playing around or running around in the playground. This is engaging in, you know, soccer, engaging in a sport where they're going to be maybe colliding with another individual, maybe having to place their own force, their body weight against an individual. That's one of the arguments or, you know, I guess dialogues that I've opened up with that. Upper body strength is important. Lower body strength is important. Anterior to posterior balance, you know, all that is indicating that they have a good posterior chain, their glutes, their hamstrings are strong, their low back is also strong, and there's not an imbalance front side to back side, okay? Core strength. Core strength is also something that has to be addressed as well. I've addressed this with my kids growing up as well, but I did not, don't assume I just put my daughter or my son underneath a barbell. No, they started off with body weight exercises, push-ups, sit-ups, single leg, you know, sit-to-stand, bench squats, just to at least start a base before we moved on into more advanced maneuvers. The posterior chain, that shouldn't be a new term to anybody. The posterior chain is something that I heavily emphasize when I'm working with an athlete regarding a post-ACL reconstruction, any type of ACL or knee reconstruction. That's one of the things that we really hit on hard. And if you disagree with this concept, please raise your hand. That's good, though. I'm glad we're all on the same page. And this goes on just not just for kids that are participating in athletics. Bowling Green is up in Northwest Ohio. Okay, I've already been asked if it was in Kentucky. It's not in Kentucky. That's another school. This is in Ohio, northwest corner, just 20 minutes south of Toledo, about an hour south of Detroit. Our previous coach just left to go to Syracuse. Okay, got a better deal there. We did inherit one of our own from the state of Texas, Mike Jenks from Texas Tech. He's now the head coach at Bowling Green State. I can't say our coach's name, but you should be able to kind of Google who that is, and that was kind of his key words, Google it. You know, you don't believe me? Google it. All right. So he's been gone, and he was a key individual that at his age, you know, 50-plus years, was always hurt. I mean, he spent more time in the athletic training room than some of our athletes did. Shoulder issues, neck issues, back issues. And one of the key things that I was on him at before he left, maybe a few months before I even knew he was gone away, I had a heart-to-heart with him. I told him, Coach, you got to do something, man. You got to be consistent with your training. You got to work your posterior chain, your small muscle groups, your rotator cuff muscles, because he had shoulder issues from college. He played at Hawaii, low back issues from weightlifting training. And all sorts of problems, but he was not an individual that was going to take care of himself. So this has more applications than just athletics alone, more so than just, this is a long life-term event. You guys got to maintain a certain amount of strength just to live your life, and as active as athletic trainers are, I think it carries great benefit to continue with that. I don't have this on there, but neck strength is also something that I think needs to be addressed as well, especially in sports like middle school football, high school football, soccer, wrestling, anything where the head's going to be vulnerable and maybe receive an impact or blow, that also has to have at least a decent amount of attention towards strengthening. All right, the This gentleman here within in the picture kind of represents what my goal was to as far as attaining flexibility. I was a big Bruce Lee fan. Never could quite get to that limit on the doing the split leg stretch, but it's something to aspire to, okay? For the flexibility and range of motion issues, we tend to try and get our student athletes at BG to get to 90 degrees. That's at least a fair level of measure for them to strive towards. Quad stretch test, which is the Elis test, getting them on their stomach and bringing their heel to their butt. We want to try that to get the heel to the butt, make contact or within 30 degrees. That's also going to give us another measure of flexibility, range of motion to shoot towards. I am actually surprised as to how many student athletes are not able to touch their toes, okay? At the level that we start working with athletes, either through a growth spurt or maybe not ever paying attention to flexibility work, this is something that they've neglected throughout their career or as an athlete. And ankle dorsiflexion, that's something that I think doesn't get enough attention. 20 degrees is something that we try to get our athletes to, and by minimizing or improving an athlete's ankle dorsiflexion or range of motion there, we've seen a lot of reduction in calf issues, hamstring issues, and in addition to that, it's also helped minimize a lot of our low back problems, okay? Are there any questions at this point with this concept here? Hamstring 90-90, I mean, that's pretty simple. This is one of the tests that we end up doing with our athletes, and they can be on their back. It's easiest to do on their back on a table that we have. We actually have a stretch table that we put our athletes on. Lift their leg up as high as possible, past 90 degrees. It's important that they keep the leg locked. We don't do any type of stretch therapy with their leg locked until they've been used to this for a while. But for this measurement alone, we do expect the athlete to have the knee locked. And then we assess the ankle using a goniometer. The easiest thing is to kind of eyeball it. You can kind of tell that the model there in the picture is at about 90 degrees. And we measure both legs. Quad stretch test, just like I described, athletes on the table or on the floor, bend the leg. It's usually good to try and not crank on that ankle towards the buttocks area. Okay, we don't want anybody screaming or causing any quad strain during this measurement. And again, you can use a goniometer to assess this measurement or kind of eyeball it, and we do this bilaterally. All right, the individual on the left in the red shirt cannot touch his toes, okay? How many of you think this is a low back issue? Raise your hand. How many think it's a hamstring issue? Raise your hand, please, okay? The individual on the right side with the, I don't know what color shirt that is, we'll say pink. He's obviously able to touch his toes, but he's doing it with the compensation of bending his knee slightly, okay? So these are kind of things that we look for in assessing some of our student athletes. Ankle dorsiflexion, this is one of the measurements that we take. 10 degrees is normal. We've seen that happen quite a bit. 20 degrees is optimal for our student athletes. And again, it's often an overlooked limiting factor in the posterior chain. It could add hamstring issues, and these are some things that you can kind of visually see. The individual on the right, he's got limited ankle dorsiflexion. You can kind of see his right knee is going a little bit valgus. Optimally, you want a offensive lineman to have decent amount of ankle dorsiflexion to be able to comfortably sit in that position, right? Sit in that position, be able to move readily laterally. Either way, and be able to take on a block or move forward and engage in a block. But that's one of the things that even the NFL scouts that come up and talk to me, if they're interested in the player, that's one of the things that they look for in the athletes. Quick test, just to eyeball it, some of this we do with our student athletes if we're short on hands or short on students. We just have the kids go up to the wall and we ask them to dorsiflex their toes towards the knee. Okay, 1 inch represents about 10 degrees, so they're able to get their toes 2 inches. That's approximately the 20-degree angle we want to accomplish, okay? And that's something that, even in the high school setting with limited staff and students, you could potentially engage in. Any questions at this point? And please feel free to jump in. If you don't agree with one of the points that we're making here, I'm glad to talk it out with you, or we can talk after I'm done talking up here. Okay, posture assessment. This is the one thing that I really feel I've been doing over the last 6 years. being able to visually see a student athlete and being able to indicate or assess what problems they have just by seeing them standing, okay? Muscular anatomy, you know, if they're overdeveloped on one side can cause a overbalance on that one end and create a postural imbalance. Easy assessment, I mean, you want everything to be even, left to right, hips, you know, get your anatomical landmarks and make sure that they're even left to right. And also lateral, you know, laterally measure, you know, ear to ankle, whether or not they're swaying one way or the other. Looking at this individual, I mean, this is just a plumb line measurement, and this is a pretty good posture for an individual, but the middle slide kind of shows you that his ear is not in line with his ankle, so he's kind of swaying forward just a little bit. And on the right slide, you can kind of tell that he's a little bit off center as well, okay? And may not be a big issue. This gentleman might be healthy. This gentleman might not have any low back or hip flexor issues or anything of that nature, but it's just something to note. Leg length discrepancy, we probably see this maybe one of the most common issues that we see where I'm currently at Bowling Green. He's just doing a leg length test, true versus apparent. Just a big review, apparent, okay, there is a measurement issue, but it's not a true leg length discrepancy. I mean, the femur is usually at a shorter, it's usually the femur that's contributing to this discrepancy problem, okay? But this is a way to figure it out. And by addressing this with a lift or maybe some type of pelvic balance, you can really sidestep a lot of soft tissue problems. Here's an x-ray of an actual person. You can kind of see where the knee joint landmarks are. The right leg is slightly elevated over the left, and you can tell right at the feet, it's creating a lift off the ground. So if you can imagine this person being a distance runner, the amount of stress and load on that right side might cause an imbalance and maybe cause problems left or right. I've seen it happen both ways. Now, the gentleman on the right has been riding, or the left has been riding a horse for his whole life, okay? You got the bow-legged syndrome, the genu valgum posture, and number three is the genu recurvatum. You tend to see number two in ladies with the Q angle, and that really sets them up for a lot of potential knee problems, okay? Genu recurvatum, that could, you know, cause some other knee problems as well. Number one, I mean, you guys, hopefully this is just review, and these are just some things that you can point out and hopefully address as well. Lower leg posture, the person has a foot drop on the left side, that person might benefit from an orthotic, okay? If you identify this, and are able to, you know, have this person place in an orthotic or orthosis, that could help them, especially if they're a runner. If they're any active athlete, you know, some support in that area could help sidestep some problems. Good posture on the left, poor posture on the right, things that you can really get keen on addressing and assessing as well. We're going back to this individual, still looks pretty healthy to me, same picture, no real change. And then we have the other problems here. Some persons, it's going to have the first model is kind of close to the previous picture, okay? Ear to ankle looks good. But the kyphosis in the second skeletal model, it's very, very obvious, okay? The flat back posture, you can tell the normal curvature in the spine isn't there or where it should be. And then the sway back posture is also just an increased forward tilt of the pelvis. And if you see individuals like that, that kind of reminds me of the from Scooby-Doo, Shaggy's body posture and how he walked during the cartoons. All right, here, another over-exaggeration of the postures that you see, sway back, lumbar lordosis, thoracic kyphosis, forward head, and good posture. Okay, good posture. I don't see too many individuals standing like at attention like the good posture model. But again, over exaggeration, just some things to kind of look at. Real life pictures of a person with some scoliosis. Really, there's some things you can do for a person that has this problem. Some doctors feel, some chiropractors have spoken with me that there are some muscle balance exercises that you can do to maybe help get a more neutral spine, but as far as getting it completely straight, it's not going to happen, or it very seldom happens unless it's a very minimal case. This is another picture of person with scoliosis, and I've had athletes at practice and participate in games with scoliosis. Here, hyperlordosis, this is something that you might see in your offensive linemen or other individuals. You can kind of see the gentleman with the blue trunks has an over curve of that lumbar spine. The gentleman on the right, not quite as obvious, so he's more of a normal case. Real life kyphoelordotic picture, you can see his upper thoracic is a little bit more rounded than what you'd like to see, and he's got a little bit of lordosis down at the bottom as well. More posture assessments. These are things that maybe just through corrective posture, you know, teaching, reminding an athlete to stand up straight and engage their popular musculature is something that they can address on their own. And the forces at play, okay? One of the things that we worry about is more of the pelvic alignment, the pelvic tilt. If the pelvis is tilted too far forward, that's going to increase the curvature in the lumbar spine and increase the amount of pressure that you've already are experiencing in a very limited area in the low back. If they're tilted backwards, that's going to flatten out the lumbar spine and also create some other problems. But if we can talk musculoskeletal, you got the pelvic on the first illustration here. It's tilted forward, so that's going to put an added stretch on the hamstrings. Okay, that means that you either got some tight quadriceps that you can address, and it's also going to create some tight hamstring problems, or put excess torque on the hamstrings. Same goes for the second slide. The opposite is going on the slide or the third illustration. Hamstrings are too tight, and it's also going to create some unnecessary stresses on the quadricep muscles, if you can see that. For me, quick assessments I'm going to share with you are our pre-participation exam that we do at Bowling Green. But for me, I can take an athlete and get them on a table and quickly go through an assessment and identify areas of concern within about a minute. And it's just going through all the tests, quad flexibility, hamstring flexibility, low back, whether or not they can touch their toes, ankle mobility, and glute flexibility. Now, all we do for glute flexibility is just get them on their back and see if we can bring their hip or knee up to 90-90 and see if we can how much we can get the knee over across their midline, okay? And glute flexibility tends to be something that all athletes need to work on. Could you please raise your hand if you are FMS trained or have used FMS at your current setting? Or how many of you have heard of FMS, the functional movement screening? Okay, but how many of you actually use it in your high school setting or clinical site? No? Okay. We started using FMS screening when I was at Southeast Missouri in 2009. And we use it for about 4 years. And it was actually our strength and conditioning coach that headed this up. And he decided to follow this train of thought, this practice, based on what one of the strength coaches that I worked with at Missouri was doing. And at that time, he was with the Atlanta Falcons, and there was a big write-up as to how the Falcons were doing FMS training and that they were, you know, following it to the letter of the law. And the gist of it was that if an athlete didn't score out of the 7 tests, a minimum of, I think it's 16 out of a potential 21 or so, they weren't allowed to advance into the more difficult exercises. They had to do corrective exercises, they had to do technique work, and essentially, you know, just stay with the correctives until they got a better score on this FMS screening. For 4 years we did this, okay, and I helped do a lot of the screening. And I liked it. I liked the concept. I liked the idea of it. And let me just see what the next slide is. Okay, we can go back to that. The debate was this. Our head coaches were bringing in kids from, you know, JUCOs to play at SEMO, and they weren't being allowed to lift because they were doing terribly on their FMS scores, okay? We had a couple of guys that were in the single digits, which is not good if you're doing following this FMS philosophy. We had an offensive lineman and a defensive lineman that both scored a 9 on each one, and they ended up getting in a fight at practice one day, and it became the battle of the 9s. I mean, it was that bad. I mean, so we had to make light of the score, and So the coaches, they wanted to change, and they wanted kids to lift, and the strength coach really wanted to stick with us. So they were butting heads on how to train the athletes. Ultimately, I think if it's a coach's team, you know, a coach has the right to, you know, have their team trained as they would like. And as a strength coach, you have to be flexible with your own methodology and your thought process. So this was constantly going on, and our strength coach kind of adapted a little bit, and he went from strict FMS to modified FMS, and I think that's still how they train their student athletes down there. He's the only strength coach that I know that has implemented this in the college setting that I've worked with, okay? The research quandary, okay. We're doing this for 4 years, and I'm noticing through my injury report and our data collection that we're reducing our soft tissue injuries, so hamstrings, quadricep injuries, any soft tissue injury, you know, that you can see during the season in football, we're being reduced. And I thought this would be a great research project for one of our graduate assistants. So I gave him all of our data, and he also got the data from the strength and conditioning staff, and what they were doing was comparing the scores to the injury rate that we were seeing. And there was no correlation. There was zero correlation, and I was a little bit upset. I thought that we would actually find something in there, you know, with all the numbers we put in, and it was a decent sample size, over 3 years, 100, you know, athletes. You would think you'd come up with some better information than that. The only correlation that he found was that this test, I don't know if I can point it out, the rotary stability test, which is this thing even work? Here we go. This test right here, which measures core stability, the worse you did on this test, the more you were inclined or you had a higher rate of injury that we saw. Okay, so if you did poorly, you got a one on this, you were more likely to get injured. And I thought about it, I'm like, wow, I mean, everything else doesn't tell us anything, not even the 90-90 or the other tests that we were looking at. And these are all the seven tests that FMS does, okay? The squatting, the stepping over the band, the forward lunge, reaching behind your neck, which is measures upper extremity flexibility, 90-90, and then the push-up maneuver. So I was a little bit disappointed, but did make sense to me after I thought about it. The rotary stability test measures core strength. So if you're lacking any significant amount of core strength, you're probably more prone to injury because you're not able to transfer the forces from the ground through your core, through your upper extremity, especially in a sport of football where there's a lot of collisions going on. This is what we do at Bowling Green. We do some structural tests, the true versus apparent leg length discrepancy, hip height and sacral rotation, the Thomas test, the Ober's test, Ely's test. Actually, I just stick with the Ely's test. Hamstring 90-90, sacral fixation, ankle mobility, and low back and toe touch maneuver. And this is actually a grid that we take most of our teams in, take them through. They get whether or not they need improvement. We don't actually score this. It's just something that we may put down a measurement and address it with some corrective exercises. And it's worked well. I mean, we've got at least maybe 15% of the football team that has corrective stuff, and they come in religiously. So they've seen improvement in their mobility, seen reduction in their soft tissue injuries, and have also improved in their athletic, you know, performance as well. If they can stay on the field, they're going to see that as a positive. The other movement part of this is the single leg squat, overhead squat, and we do manual muscle testing as well. Whether an athlete is able to do a single leg bridge or a single leg RDL, and we've also incorporated the rotary stability test, which is that test we just mentioned about on the FMS measurement system. We also incorporate some dynamic rhythms as corrective exercises. You guys may not be able to see this, but I have a couple of rubber bands on my wrist. But all I'm doing is, if you can kind of pretend, if you can't see this, I'm just, you know, expanding the rubber band, okay? And that's how we understand our tissue and fascia and tendons to be. And so over time, what's going to happen to this band if I keep, you know, stretching it, expanding it, you know, time over time? It's going to stretch out and increase in length, okay? Or it's going to get longer, okay? And that's our goal with these dynamic rhythms. And the person on the right is working, or on the left, excuse me, is working on hamstring and hip flexibility, making sure that the hips are facing forward. and the lady on the right is also doing a modified version of that. And we have these athletes come in and do something like this, maybe 3 to 4 sets of 20 repetitions each side just to get them loose. We do a lot of other work with them, but this is just an example of some of the things that we do with our student athletes. This individual is doing some dynamic glute rhythms, okay? So he's going to be doing assuming a glute stretch position, and he's going to kind of lean into it and then come back, lean into it and then come back to try and work some glute flexibility as well. The illustration on the right, that's the position we have our athletes to do a quadricep rhythm. They're going to be kind of leaning back into the quadricep and coming back nice and gentle. This is kind of a we're not trying to create a dynamic stretch. We're just trying to create a nice little dynamic or slow tug of the muscle so it'll adapt over time to the length we want to try to get it to, or loosen up some of the muscle where we feel it's causing a problem. So what does all this mean? You know, there's some corrective exercises that you can do with your athletes if you can identify some of the problems. Limits and range of motion, you know, once you address them, can alleviate or eliminate some of the soft tissue problems. You have to be balanced, okay? You need to address the core, you need to address the flexibility issues that come along the way, and you want to, that, I mean, that's essentially the goal, if I can just read that verbatim. The goal is to have a more sound, a core strong, balanced, flexible, relatively speaking, because some athletes are going to be tight most of their career athlete. And these can, if you're doing, you know, working with coaches, student coaches, strength coaches, they can include this in their warm-up. You know, this can kind of be the pre-participation routine for your student athletes. And once you kind of coach them on what to do, they can essentially handle it on their own. And we typically measure a student athlete once every 2 to 3 weeks just to make sure they're making progress and not digressing. And they can do this in their room. They can do this while they're watching TV. They can do static holds while they're watching TV. And by addressing this problem, we have seen tremendous benefits from that. This is kind of just the gist of the dynamic rhythms. They're addressing the limits in the range of motion. They should be gentle to the point of tug and restriction. It should not be painful. I mean, if you've got a crazy athlete that's going to, you know, work hard and run through a wall for you, you may need to put the restraints on them, because this is something that's supposed to be handled nice and easy. Strict and form-driven. Okay, you don't want an athlete, if I'm trying to do a dynamic rhythm, I don't want my hips opening up. I want them to be going forward and linear. You can do them multiple times throughout the day, and just like I said, four sets of 20 to 30 repetitions each body part, each session that we're trying to get the athlete in for. Dynamic to static. All right. How many of you guys are fans of static stretching still? I like static stretching. I do. I still do a lot of that. I think athletes, you'll have some schools of thought, some student athlete or coaches do not like to do any type of static stretching. Some athletes feel they need to have static stretching. As far as my belief, I'm a fan of it. If a kid needs to spend some extra time after a dynamic warm-up and stretch, that's great. We currently have a new strength coach at BG that Coach Jinks brought up with, Billy Yates, who loves him some warm-up. I mean, that gentleman, I mean, our guys are, after 45 minutes, still warming up. So that's a tremendously long warm-up event. And I've told him that he loves him some warm-up, and he laughed about it. The dynamic movements, I think dynamic exercises are a benefit to the student athletes if they're able to get into the positions appropriately and not exacerbate or make a position worse for themselves. Okay, RG3 on the left. Gentleman on the right, he's got a little bit too much oil on his body, but he's got a good squat form, right? RG3, can you guys see his knees? Remember, RG had some problems with his knee, continues to have some knee issues. You could kind of tell RG3 had a little bit of a genu valgum issue playing, even in his days at Baylor, okay? And I wish him the best of luck in his career, but that you can kind of see that being a predisposition for some knee issues. And watching form and technique is always important. Soft tissue therapy is one of the things that I've worked on, and I spent a lot of time researching and practice. For my students, when I teach, when I'm bringing in graduate assistants, talking to my staff, talking to students, I always preach that the site of pain is not always the cause of the problem, okay? If we got knee pain, I know our practice as ATCs has always been to address the site of pain. We're going to do some stem and ice on you, and you know, maybe do some strengthening around that area. But that was kind of it. We need to kind of think outside the area of injury. Okay, knee pain, what does that mean? All right, is there some quadricep tightness that we're looking at? Are there some masses of tissue contracture along the quadricep? What's the flexibility like? What's your quadricep range of motion like? Is it hamstring tightness that's contributing to this? What about the pelvis? Is the pelvis tilted forward, which would mean an overtaut quadricep muscle? Or is it tilted backwards, which could mean the opposite? Hamstrings are tight, putting a lot of excess stretch on the quadricep. And then what could have contributed to the problem? I mean, if you got a distance athlete that has all these problems and is experiencing knee pain, kind of the same, you know, workup as well, you know, flexibility, posture, ankle mobility, and you know, see what else you can come up with. Posture, limits of range of motion are also some things to contribute to that, and also head to toe. I mean, that's the one thing that we try to practice with our program. Let me see what this next slide is. Ooh, wrong slide. Okay. Muscle fascia is very intriguing. I know that there have been more so recently some research in the area of muscle fascia, and you know what a fibrous, you know, benefit it is to the body, how it supports the muscle. But I don't know that it's been actually given the weight or importance of how it actually contributes to movement. Okay, you've got a lot of experts that do myofascial release, a lot of people that do myofascial therapy. You know, I've attended various clinics pertaining to those topics. But it's something to think about. I think there was a paper that I read where there was an athlete. You know, the illustration on the right kind of gives you the patterns or the pathways of how the fascia tends to run within the body. And there was a cadaver that was they studied the cadaver. There was a history of the person being a baseball player. And there was a more thickening and broadening fascial layer on the right side, and he was a right-handed pitcher, than there was on the left. So what would that indicate to you? We're not talking about muscle imbalance. We're talking about the muscle fascia itself. So, and to me, that was pretty enlightening. I mean, that you're not also worried about muscle development, but you're also worried about the muscle fascia contributing to the limitation as well. And left illustration just kind of indicates the train or the myofascial trains that or the pathways that it's followed. And the Spider-Man looking character on the right is kind of how the fascia operates. Okay. Now we do Graston technique at Bowling Green, but we just don't, when I first got there, that's all that the staff was doing, just Graston work. Well, I really felt we needed to address that more so. If we're going to do Graston, we need to incorporate that with some dynamic stretching. We need to do some soft tissue mobilization as well to really reap the benefits of what we're trying to accomplish. But the illustration on the right kind of gives you an idea, you know, your fascia or the tight spot on the right shoulder might be affecting an area over the left knee, okay? Do any of you use these devices, foam rollers? Raise your hands, please, if you PVC. PVC is where it be. That's what I tell my athletes. Painful, but very beneficial. We actually use shot puts in our area just to get a little bit more focal, soft tissue mobilization. And I always tell our athletes that if it's going to be painful and that they might see a white light, but don't go into the light, okay? And if they pass out, we're just going to draw a chalk line outside their body until they get up. So, but anyway, I'm a firm believer in all these devices. We actually have a soft tissue or a stretch table as pictured on the left that I incorporate into a lot of our mobility work, and it does take a little bit of time. And I know as athletic trainers, time is not something we have the luxury of having too much of. But you know, for some athletes that are in need of it, I you know, we'll spend the time with them, and it's usually maybe a 10 to 15 minute stretch therapy session following some mobility work, following some Graston that's been done the previous day. So I wanted to tell you about this case study, and I'm almost done. So. This is, I thought, very unique and kind of ties everything together. This gentleman on the right is, you may or may not have heard of him. His name is Christian Cantwell. I worked with him at Missouri when I was with track and field, and he's an Olympian. I don't know how much money he makes these days. I haven't spoken to him for a while, but his case is pretty interesting. When I first got to Mizzou, of all things, this gentleman has like about 500 pounds on the bar and, you know, strains his pec. So everybody was really concerned about this individual, and we had four coaches at the doctor's office with me to see what was wrong with Christian, and it just was a minor pec strain, but it was something that we needed to address in rehab. He suffered a hand injury later that season where he tore the lumbrical muscles in his palm. I learned too much about hand musculature after this case, but he couldn't throw, and this was potentially, for a thrower, a career-ending injury, and he still had about 3 years to compete in the college setting, and he kind of just shut down because he was not able to throw. We were working with a massage therapist. We were seeing an orthopedic hand specialist, and eventually got him to throw again. But the individual did have an anterior pelvic tilt, okay, tight quadriceps. I mean, Christian was just tight all over the place. I've never seen so much white muscle fiber on a human being than on this kid. 6'5", 330, that's a good size individual. So, and he did have some limiting quad range of motion. Hold on. So going back to Esteban, the gentleman with the killer thumb, he worked on Christian, but he didn't just work on Christian in the right pec. He worked on right hand, right forearm, right bicep, right pec, right iliopsoas, left quad, left anterior tib, all the way down to his left toe. He strongly felt that the right hand injury, because Christian had suffered a toe injury the year before, okay? And Esteban strongly felt that the left toe injury in some shape or form contributed to the right hand injury, okay? And I'm thinking, Esteban, keep your thumb to yourself. I don't really believe what you're saying. But now I can kind of see that, okay? And I'm not really trying to stir up a bad batch of Kool-Aid, but these are some ideas that were thrown out at me, and being in a better state of mind, I can more readily accept. And these are the credits. You guys have any questions for me at this point in time? Because I'm done talking, so. If not, I'm going to hang out here for a few minutes. You guys can kind of approach if you feel the need to. But thank you to Spats. I appreciate it. Yes, sir. Go ahead. Yeah. Everything. PNF, static holds, rhythmic stretching, anything that you can imagine, we do it. And we do a lot of PNF as well. So whatever you kind of feel, it's just one of the tools in your bag, you know, whatever you feel is appropriate at that time, depending on how bad the athlete's range of motion is, that's what we use to incorporate. But we do a lot of PNF as well. Very effective, very effective.